Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Cluster outbreaks of COVID-19 in Yellowstone and Bighorn counties, starting in-person classes at Cottonwood Elementary in Gallatin County, and today's primary election. It's Tuesday, June 2nd. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The Montana Department of Agriculture says it's seen an influx of domestic pigs coming from Midwestern states where major processing plants are closed down due to COVID-19. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports officials are reminding those buying pigs about livestock import requirements.
Major Midwest pork producers have been left with few options for selling their pigs. The Department of Ag says Montanans are beginning to buy some of those animals through unconventional channels. The department is reminding buyers of import requirements such as obtaining health certificates, import permits, and identification tags. Ag officials are also asking first-time buyers to be prepared to properly fence in pigs not immediately destined for a local slaughterhouse. The department warns that domestic pigs can quickly revert to a feral state if they escape. The department began a public campaign last year to increase awareness about its efforts to prevent the spread of feral swine, which can cause millions of dollars in crop and property damage into the state. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Montana Governor Steve Bullock says First Amendment rights need to be protected as President Donald Trump is calling for governors to respond with force to violent protests popping up around the nation in response to the death of George Floyd.
We need to recognize that, I mean, people across this country, indeed, many Montanans are in pain, and we need to protect avenues for people to express those First Amendment rights. Doing so can be done lawfully and peacefully.
Rallies in Floyd's honor and against systematic racism have popped up in several Montana cities in recent days. Those haven't turned violent, but nationwide protests have sparked violent clashes between protesters and police. Yesterday, Trump called for governors to deploy the National Guard, adding if they didn't take actions to defend property, he'll mobilize the military. Billings rally organizer Amber Palmer expects a peaceful, socially distanced event this weekend. She says it won't require the National Guard.
I don't see the need when the protest is peaceful to deploy such serious, I guess, manpower against it.
She believes President Trump's comments are a reaction to the riots in larger cities and comes from a place of fear. The Billings protest begins Sunday at 1 p.m. Judith Heilman is the founder and executive director of the Montana Racial Equity Project, a Bozeman-based nonprofit that helped organize Bozeman Rally for Black Lives on Sunday that drew over 1,000 people. In response to Trump's remarks about law enforcement dominating the streets, Heilman said,
I can speak to Montana about that and say that's not necessary.
Gun and ammunition sales are surging nationally, and Montana is no exception. According to the FBI, there were over 3 million background checks last month, the highest for any May on record. So far this year, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System has logged over 15 million checks, putting it on track to beat last year's high of 28 million.
I would say at least two-thirds of the record number of firearms that have sold in the last 60 days are first-time gun owners, gun purchasers.
James Zimmerman is owner and general manager of Missoula's Selway Armory. Zimmerman says customers mention several factors, including the coronavirus pandemic and the growing social unrest following the alleged murder of George Floyd.
People are concerned about their safety, you know? And they feel that, as we've seen with these riots, you know, the government cannot always protect you.
Zimmerman says 9mm defensive pistols are among the most popular firearms available. He predicts no end in sight to the strong demand for the remainder of the year. More than a dozen new cases of the COVID-19 illness in Montana can be traced to two separate cluster outbreaks in Yellowstone and Bighorn counties, officials say. I found out more. The majority of more than 20 new cases in Bighorn County were identified through contact tracing investigations that crossed the border of the Crow Indian Reservation. Rhonda Johnson, public information officer for Bighorn County.
It's not one particular town. It's not one particular event. It's not on the reservations or off the reservations. It's really all throughout Bighorn County. And so that's why we're constantly reminding, some people may say harping, on taking precautions.
Johnson says testing in the county has expanded to include anyone who wants one during sentinel surveillance testing events. Five of the county's total 31 cases were found from recent mass testing events. 23 cases are currently active, but Johnson says there could be more as tests from other events are processed. The 12 new cases in Yellowstone County are centered around an outbreak at the county's detention center. A female inmate at the Yellowstone County Detention Facility tested positive for COVID-19 last week. Since then, Riverstone Health has tested 42 inmates and 41 jail staff. Seven more female inmates and one jail staff member have tested positive. One inmate is currently hospitalized while the others have been isolated. John Felton, CEO and president of Riverstone Health in Billings and Yellowstone County Health Officers, says YCDF will continue to follow guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, such as screening people for symptoms, increased sanitation, and social distancing when possible.
Governor Bullock has really made a concerted effort to push towards more surveillance testing. And so there is some supplies and equipment available for that. So we'll be working with the State Health Department to determine, as we move down the path of surveillance testing, where this particular facility fits in that.
The state's largest spike in new cases since April comes as Montana is entering into phase two of its economic reopening plan Monday. For YPR News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. On a press call yesterday, Governor Steve Bullock said he isn't considering reinstating restrictions due to the rise in cases, though county and tribal governments may adopt more restrictive orders than the state. While most Montana schools decided to finish out the year online, some of the smaller, more rural districts opted to reopen under new guidelines. Rachel Kramer reports from Cottonwood Elementary in Gallatin County, where in-person learning started last week.
Let's try to remember C first, where you just have your third finger.
On the basketball court, five upper elementary students and their teacher, Abby Eichenberger, sit 6 feet apart in a circle, practicing chords on ukuleles. A nearby stream, swollen with snowmelt, rushes behind a fence while cottonwoods sway in the warm spring breeze. As Montana began lifting COVID-19 restrictions last month, school districts across the state had the option of continuing online learning or resuming in-person classes. Eichenberger says her school board asked for parent input to make the decision for the students in the K-5 school.
We had an overwhelming majority say, let's just do field-based learning because it's so much work to clean the school, open the school, and only for a couple of weeks, if that. So they all just thought it sounded great to learn outside and get the kids back together.
Eichenberger says a small number of students, only 6 in the upper grade levels, and the space to spread out means they can more easily follow public health guidelines compared to larger schools. She says one family decided not to send their kids back for the remaining 2 weeks. This morning, the students continue a unit they started before COVID-19 about the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Eichenberger hands out laminated worksheets showing different types of compound and simple leaf structures, and the students search for matches around the school.
It's got pointy edges. Like, this isn't simple. I think it's compound. Oh, yeah, you're right. It's really compound.
During the school's 2-month closure, Eichenberger posted online videos and lesson plans each morning. At midday, they checked in over video chat.
I'm just so proud of how my students have, even not being in the same room as me, continued to learn and grow and be creative.
Eichenberger says she thinks the school's Montessori model of education, which emphasizes hands-on and independent learning, helped her students adapt. But she says it was challenging not seeing them in person every day and harder to know if someone was struggling and needed some extra help. Educators nationwide expect some amount of instructional regression. They're calling it the COVID slide. But students at Cottonwood are feeling with more immediacy the loss of companionship. 8-year-old Freya Campbell and her classmates all say they are glad to be back at school so they can see their friends.
It's hard to stay away from people you love and care about.
Yeah, it is.
I wouldn't think not hugging someone would be so hard for even 8 weeks.
For now, the students are still practicing social distancing. Instead of touching someone's head during Duck Duck Goose, they use pool noodles.
If you notice someone getting too close to you and not being social distance, what do you say?
Noodle!
Campbell says her older sister attends a large middle school in Bozeman, which decided to continue with online school for the rest of the semester.
And is she a little bit jealous that you get to come here while she has to stay home?
Oh, no. She is absolutely loving this. And I think she actually likes me being gone for a little bit because, honestly, I like being with her, but it's true. Sometimes it is nice to get away from people you know.
Her dad, Charlton Campbell, says he and his wife are self-employed and work from home. He says there are a lot of benefits to smaller schools, especially during times like this.
You know, I supported the closing. I mean, it's a scary time. So especially with my oldest daughter being in one of the larger schools, I felt comfortable not having her go. If Cottonwood had stayed open, I probably would have let Freya come because it is such a small school. And so, I mean, there's less than 10 people in the classroom.
10-year-old Alec Roth says he likes having school outside, but he warns me you have to watch out for spiders.
I found a spider nest and it hatched.
Oh.
Like multiple of them.
Wow.
Like multiple spider nests.
Okay, so keep your eyes out for spiders.
Yeah.
With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Rachel wore a mask and disinfected her equipment before talking to people while reporting. A record number of Montanans have submitted ballots for today's primary election. Kevin Trevlin reports that those who haven't voted still have time.
County election officials had received more than 312,000 ballots for Montana's first all-mail-in ballot election as of Sunday night, nearly 19,000 more votes than the previous primary record set in 2016. Nearly 45% of registered voters have returned ballots for this year's primary. That number is lower than other counts that don't include inactive voters. Butte Silverbow has one of the highest turnout rates among Montana's urban counties, almost 53%. Elections Administrator Sally Hollis thinks competitive races are driving high votership.
You're looking at national, you're looking at state, and then you're looking at county. There's just a lot on the ballot, and I think people want to vote and make their voice heard.
Like many of Montana's more populated counties, Butte Silverbow had already begun counting ballots ahead of Election Day. Eric Riley, an associate professor of political science at Montana State University, says the all-mail-in system is likely boosting turnout. He says surveys from his lab suggest the novel coronavirus pandemic could be a factor too.
People are at home and looking for things to do, and so they're going through their mail and they're filling things out and turning them back in.
Riley says strong name recognition among candidates running for the governor's office, U.S. House, and U.S. Senate may also contribute to strong turnout. Numbers aren't high in every region, however. Only 24% of registered voters submitted ballots in Bighorn County, where in-person voting is typically preferred. Flathead County has low turnout among Montana's high population counties, about 39%. Ballot returns have also slumped mildly in Montana's academic hotspots, according to Riley. Missoula and Gallatin counties have seen 41 and 37% turnout, respectively.
It's a little bit of a puzzle. Those stand out to me.
Despite the low percentage, more Gallatin County voters have submitted ballots than in any other primary election there. It's not too late for those who still have their envelopes. Voters can submit ballots at county election offices until 8 p.m. Tuesday. Many counties also offer separate drop-off locations. Kevin Trevlin, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Two different versions of Montana conservatism have been butting heads for years in the State House, and they'll be pitted against each other again in this week's primary election as GOP voters choose between factions of the Republican Party, business-minded Republicans willing to work across the aisle, and party hardlines who legislate with strict ideology. Reporter Eric Dietrich with the Montana Free Press has been following this rift within GOP lawmakers. He shared his recent reporting previewing primary races within the Republican Party with Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney.
Was there a particular issue before the Montana legislature last year that really illustrated this difference between the two wings of the GOP?
Was the debate over the Medicaid expansion renewal bill. If you don't remember, that was a bill that re-upped a program that provides health care for about 80,000 Montanans, particularly lower-income Montanans. And it passed initially in 2015, was up for renewal last year. This is a program that had been pretty much universally applauded by public health advocates. But, of course, hardline conservatives saw it as a big government boondoggle and wanted to see it chopped. So there's one group of the Republicans, the Solutions Caucus, that we've heard a fair amount about. One of their members, Ed Vetri out of Great Falls, put together a renewal bill. And that bill ultimately passed. It support from moderate Republicans and Democrats, opposition from hardline Republicans. It was signed by the governor, who, of course, is a Democrat.
And that Solutions Caucus you mentioned, that refers to that caucus of maybe moderates willing to make deals with Democrats but leave the party hardliners behind.
The folks in the Solutions Caucus actually prefer the label Conservative Solutions Caucus. And their argument there is that to some extent that's political branding, but their argument is that their values are as conservative as anyone's, but they say they're just more pragmatic than some of their peers about how to translate those values into policy. And again, Medicaid expansion is a good example there. There were other issues that kind of fell into the same dynamic. For example, the infrastructure bonding bill that passed through the legislature for the first time in several sessions, that's happened. And then also a bed tax increase that created a revenue stream to fund, in addition to a couple other things, a new historical society building in Helena.
Your recent report on the primary battle now playing out in this rift refers to the hardline Republicans in the state house as the 38 Special, a name they gave themselves referring to the number of lawmakers in their group and a type of handgun. It sounds like this divide between the Solutions Caucus and the 38 Special deepened during the last legislative session.
The Republicans opened last session by saying, we have a united caucus, we're going to get stuff done. And that was maybe a little bit aspirational. But by the end of the session, it was clear that the Medicaid issue in particular had seemed to drive a wedge. So during the floor debate on the House, and the House side of the Medicaid bill, there was a moment when the GOP majority leader, Brad Chita from Missoula, got up and as part of these arguments against the bill said, be aware that anyone who votes for this bill is going to need to answer to the people back home, end quote. And so there's a very clear message of fellow Republicans, we don't think your primary voters want this. Like you vote for this, you're going to have to face the consequences come primary season, which of course is where we're at now.
And so this cut you're describing between the so-called Solutions Caucus of maybe moderates willing to negotiate with Democrats, and then the more hardline 38 Special. When it comes to, how the party in the legislature is going to move forward and the primary contest, how are you seeing those play out in the primary?
We're seeing many of them challenged and attacked for their votes on Medicaid. That's been very clearly a vote that is being brought into the political process and folks are running on it, folks are being opposed based on it. And then we have races in the legislative primaries on the GOP side, both where Solutions Caucus-aligned candidates are being challenged as quote-unquote fake Republicans because of their support for the Medicaid expansion. And there are also races where some members of the 38 Special are being challenged by moderate candidates. My reporting, I tried to count, which of course is a little bit hard with legislative races sometimes, but I identified 12 primaries with right-wing challengers and 4 or 5 where hardline Republicans are facing centrist opponents.
And what's one of these primary races that pits the more conservative, relatively moderate candidates against each other that you're watching?
Yeah, so the highest profile race is almost certainly between Nancy Balance and Teresa Manzella in Senate District 44, north of Hamilton. Both those women are current representatives. Balance is a finance wonk who came in the legislature in a Tea Party way, but has moderated as she's helped write the state budget the last few sessions. Manzella has also been around a few sessions, but she's very much stuck to the hard right. She's known more for legislation like a couple bills she had last session that would have weakened childhood vaccination requirements. So there's a very clear-cut choice for voters in that district to make.
What could this mean for the next legislative session in 2021? And maybe break down for us, why would it be relevant, how Republican primaries play out and maybe not as relevant as, the Democratic primaries?
So the first thing to know is that most political observers in the state don't seem to think that the Democrats have a good chance of winning back the Montana legislature this year. It looks likely we're going to have a Republican majority again. So the question is, what does that Republican majority look like? What is the composition there? In terms of issues, we're likely going to be talking a lot about a COVID hit on the state budget going into the 2021 session. Legislative races we're looking at here will determine the balance of power within the Republican delegation, whether it's the Solutions Caucus types who are, you know, tight purse strings, but definitely do see the value of certain public programs, or hardliners who would much rather prefer to have an excuse to cut back state government. The faction that's in the driver's seat there will determine the sort of policy we get out. The other key variable here we should mention, which is a different race, but it's who's in the governor's office. Part of the reason the centrist Republicans were empowered in 2019 because they had to work with a Democratic governor who could veto legislation that was passed by the Solutions Caucus and the hard right working together. And there were a number of bills that, you know, made it through the legislature and died against the governor's veto pen. If we have a Republican in the governor's office, especially one who's aligned with the hard right, the political dynamics in the Capitol will be quite different.
Eric Dietrich is a reporter with the Montana Free Press. You can learn more about his reporting on the Free Press website and the Lowdown podcast. Eric, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Karin.
That was reporter Eric Dietrich with the Montana Free Press speaking with Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney. And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Metal Art Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.